Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Horror One and Crime with KK and Lo. What's up, Lo?
What's up, Kay?
Oh, not much. We're doing a late night sesh over here.
Little sussy sesh. Seshy.
We like to mix it up. Last week, Saturday morning. This week, Wednesday night. We like to keep it interesting.
Got to keep us on our toes, you know, keep us going.
Right, exactly. First of all, everyone, go wish Lo a happy belated birthday because it was her birthday yesterday. Well, not yesterday when you're hearing this, last Tuesday. But
you know what the crappy part is? I can't even switch the candles around. They're both fours.
Yeah, that's true. You can't really do a little flip-flop situation.
No, and next year I'm not going to want to.
Right, because then it'll just be opposite.
So, it is what it is.
Hey, embrace it.
I'm trying.
You're killing it.
So, Kay's going to take us down a crime story. But before we hop into that, we are going to do a little mini segment of, what did we call it, Kay?
Oh, yeah. What did we say? We were trying to think of a name. It was like Lowe's Hollywood Lowdown. Was that it?
Yes. Okay, people, we were just scrambling to come up with the name of it like before we started. So
literally 5 minutes ago.
So here on Lowe's Hollywood Lowdown. We're working on the jingle part, okay?
Yeah.
So, first off, like, we're not going to get into it into detail because it's still hot, fresh off the press, but freaking Diddy, sounds like his boat's going down. His white boat party yachts. Y'all better
way
get
down.
Better get your life rafts, start swimming, because it sounds like Bieber and Usher will be talking. They're saying some stuff.
And I feel like they're not going to be the only ones. Like, I feel like just more and more are going to come out. Except I would be scared to go out against him.
Well, I feel like, too, he just kind of left his boys, like, high and dry. Literally.
Yeah, he was just like, peace.
He, like, totally dipped out on his sons. They got raided for off the airplane for drugs. I think they didn't let him go. Like, it wasn't even enough to really keep him. And then his house gets raided and he's just like, peace. They can't find him. They destroyed his house. Apparently they were too, you know, harsh on the house. They went a little excessive, but it was for sex trafficking. And I mean, little by little, there's stuff coming out in the headlights. And I always believe where there's smoke, there's fire, you know. And he had that lawsuit not long ago of that girl that pressed charges at him for sexual assault. And so, you know, now there's, you know, the whole he killed Pac. I got proof. Like, we're going to keep watching this because I feel like some shit's going down with Diddy.
Yeah, I feel like there's definitely more to come with that. And like, it just happened and it's already been like craziness. So I just like am like kind of sitting on the edge of my seat waiting to see what else kind of happens and comes from it. And there's definitely going to be more.
My sister sent me a TikTok, or not a TikTok. She sent me a text earlier and it said, Diddy. It said, friend. And then it said, R. Kelly, twin, where have you been? I was dying. I'm like, oh my God, I'm dead.
I'm like, oh my, that's perfect.
Oh my God. I'm like, let the memes begin.
For honestly, like, there's about to be a storm of those.
Oh gosh. In other news, though, the Hollywood Lowdown, fresh off the press as well, I know Kay didn't really watch Selling Sunset, but I know a lot of people did. I did. I was obsessed with the drama because who's not obsessed with drama?
Right.
But Christine Quinn was kind of the very dramatic one on the show. She was the bitch of the show. She, wherever she was constantly causing drama between other coworkers and friends. And I did not like her. I was glad when she left. It was kind of a mutual agreement between the owner of Oppenheimer, which is the real estate company that's on the show, and her. She wanted off, and he's like, please go, because I am tired of the drama that you are causing. So I feel like everybody was just happy when she called it a day. So this is why when I'm reading this, I do have a little bit of struggles. So I know she caused a lot of drama. So I'm having a hard time kind of knowing where the truth is. I feel like there's going to be his side, her side, and the truth. We'll let Crystal weigh in after I tell the story.
It's a he said, she said story.
And it's all about the he said, she said bullshit.
Knew you were going to say that.
So Christine Quinn, so she's kind of painting a picture of like alleged abuse that she's experienced with her husband. They live in California in this mansion. Like I said, she was a realtor and he was a retired something or other. And so there's definitely money between the two of them. So she's 35 and she's claiming that her husband got very enraged, started yelling at her, started throwing floral arrangements that she had around the house. She claims that the argument started when there was a conversation about the dissatisfaction of their relationship. So according to the courts obtained by Page Six, it was on March 18th when all of this went down. She claimed that he then opened a can of Red Bull and threw it across the room as well, making a mess. Then he returned a short time later and was throwing dog feces at her that he pulled out of the trash. She also alleged that he pulled out his penis and began urinating on the floors, claiming in a rampage, and this went on for some time. She is also claiming that he has mental issues, including bipolar, mania, and schizophrenia, and just claiming that it just all came out, all came to a head on this night. She said he collected multiple heavy floral arrangements and started throwing them at her. He opened up a can of Dr. Pepper and proceeded to pour it all over the bed, all over the floor, while shouting and yelling abuse and further claims. She said she did not immediately call the police out of fear, claiming that Richard could have seriously injured or killed her before the police were even able to get there. She does claim that she's got videos of the incident that she started recording when he left the room. She said that she then locked him out of the master bedroom where her and her son were in there safely. And she could hear him downstairs continuing shouting, yelling, smashing and breaking things through the house. She claims that she felt terrified for her safety. She felt terrified for her son's safety. And that she does plan on starting filing for divorce. On March 19th, she claims she snuck the nanny into the house so the nanny could watch the two-year-old son while she cleaned around the house like she normally does. She said Richard began to argue about the mess and she started arguing back. It was that, you know, just fighting like you did this. This is what happened last night while you were all pissed off. She said that she was sitting there next to her son, gathering laundry on the floor. She said she was working hard. She felt a rush of air from an object hurtling towards me and our son. And the next instant I heard was the sound of glass breaking. She claims she saw broken glass in her son's hair on the floor After a few seconds, her son burst into tears and began screaming and crying. I was concerned about his health and safety. She says that she told the nanny to call the police and take her toddler upstairs to the master bedroom. She said she went and she confronted him and asked him, why would you do something like that? Why would you throw something at her son? I said, nobody can help you if he doesn't talk to someone and get help for his anger and mental issues. There's nothing anybody can do for him. Now, the police did arrest Richard shortly after. That was around 2 p.m. local time on the 19th. Now, Christine's husband says that he's filing a restraining order against her and denies hitting the son. He says that he filed a restraining order last week, and according to documents on page 6 as well, he is denying all the allegations. He said he's ordered to stay. He asked for her to stay 100 yards away from his LA home, which he had said he had also asked Quinn to move out. He said that he also asked that she is not allowed to travel with her 2-year-old son outside of LA without his permission. He claims that she has threatened to abduct their child, or she's capable of abducting their child. He claims that every time they get in a fight, he threatens to take or hide their son from him. And she is not being very cooperative when it comes to co-parenting. He points out the real estate agent, who is 35, is very close to her mother and father, and is worried she will flee to Texas where they live with their toddler. He did say that he is denying any allegations of hitting their son with a glass bottles during the dispute. While there have been never been incidents of domestic violence in their relationship throughout their marriage, he says that they have argued over the state of the house. He says Christine owns 2 dogs as pets, which she refuses to have house trained or crated trained. As a result, there is constantly dog feces throughout the house. The linens are stained with dog urine, and they are tattered and torn due to the animals' constant, uncontrollably chewing. Richard claims that the hardwood floors are permanently warped, discolored, stained, foul odors, generally damaged beyond repair. The floor in the one bathroom on the second level of the house is so soaked with dog urine that the ceiling below is stained. That is so fucking disgusting.
Foul.
Like, oh, I can't even imagine. Like, my one little dog, when we first got her, like, would pee in the living room. And I'm like, oh, my God. Can you imagine, like, multiple dogs doing it all day, every day? No.
And soaking through the ceiling.
And she's got more money than she knows what to do with. Why can you not hire someone to come and train them for you?
Yeah, what?
She could afford to do it at her house if she wanted to. He claims that he's the only one cleaning up after the dog, and he even uses vacuum cleaners, the Roomba. He uses it as a bonding activity for him and his son. So I guess maybe they make a game out of it. I don't know. Richard claims that the court docs that he and Quinn both work from home, so also they have disagreements about childcare for their son. They have no obligations in pulling them outside of the house. He repeatedly expressed that she wants 24-hour nanny coverage for their son, and he thinks that's inappropriate for 2 parents who are constantly there with the child and believes that a nanny should be done by 3 o'clock, which I kind of agree. Like, have a nanny while you guys are both at work, but once you guys are off work, there should be no need for a nanny if you guys are both home.
Yeah, like 24-hour, that's insane.
Yes. He said that on the 18th, he asked to babysit via group text with his wife to leave at 3 p.m. However, Quinn overruled this request and told the nanny to stay, so the nanny stayed. Upon learning this, he sent a group text asking all communications between Christine and himself and Alexis be on dedicated group chat, which enraged Christine and fed into repeated and unfounded concern. She expressed that Mr. Dumonte, I'm guessing that's his last name, would take away any and all nanny services, something that he said he'd never even threatened to do. So it sounds like there's a lot of like just bullshit between the two of them. They both mm-hmm. sound like they're messed up.
Yeah.
They both sound like they have issues. So he said that he alleged in the court docs that his wife was on the bed with cleaning items, soda cans, and food waste that was strewn around the room, cleaning fluid spilled on the floor and seeping into the hardwood. Towels, rags were thrown everywhere, and mostly empty trash bags filled with some soiled rags and paper towels in it from off the ground. After Quinn refused to clean up her mess in the house, Richard claimed he grabbed the trash bag from the floor and threw it to the side of the room against the wall. He did not throw a bag at Christine or their son. Additionally, he said there was no glass even in the bag. There was no broken glass in the room or anywhere near the house. He said after that, Quinn grabbed the child by the arm and took him out of the bedroom and into another room. He said he got on his computer when Quinn came and very calmly talked to him about further coming for summer vacations. So she's like, I'm mad.
Big switch up there.
Oh, can we go on vacation? And then it said she walked out of the room. Minutes later, LAPD officers stormed the bedroom with guns drawn, ordering him out of the house without any time to gather personal belongings. He was actually still in his bathrobe, which is funny because on the picture, there's like a little tiny hole in the bottom of it. I was like, these guys are so rich. And it looks like they have a robe he's wearing that he's had for years and raggedy. And I'm just like, oh, dear Lord, you think with some of that money, he'd be walking out in like a Hefner robe. I don't know.
Right, like a velvet one.
Maybe it's just his favorite one. I don't know. Like, So Richard is claiming that the police report that she filed is false. It has fabricated allegations of domestic abuse to gain upper hand in the potential divorce and custody proceedings. And he's basically denying the majority of the stuff that she's saying is like way over dramatic, not true, didn't happen. And also claims that she's using paparazzi photos of his arrest to embarrass him, humiliate him, and further accuse him as he was arrested for assault with a deadly weapon, which again, he's claiming there was no glass bottles. Page Six did reach out to Christine for a comment, but she did not answer back. So that'll be interesting to hear how that plays out. I don't know a whole lot about him, but I do know she's a crazy bitch. So would it shock me that she like over dramatic and made it seem like it was way worse than what was happening? Absolutely. Could he have possibly thrown the bag at the wall? Maybe there was a bottle in it and it accidentally shattered, not trying to hit his son, but you know, just threw it harder than he thought and like, oh shit.
Right. Like sorry. In the heat of the moment.
But I feel like if the cops were there and arrested him, and it did say in another article that the boy was taken to the hospital, they should be able to say, yes, he was covered in glass. No, he wasn't. Like that should be able to solve that issue right there. Like when the cops got there, was there glass on the floor? Was there glass in the boy's hair or no? Like,
right. And I wonder if those like details will come out, because I feel like that would be super obvious for them to check while they're like in the house hearing these like claims that she's making.
Yeah. I mean, there's got to be proof. I mean, some of the stuff she's saying is pretty like pretty big. So, I mean, if the cops walk around the house and take pictures, you know, yes, this is what happened, or like, no, it's not. I don't know. But Yeah, so I'll be following that story. And yeah, I couldn't stand her on the show anyway. She was just so, she was so mean to, I figured her name. She was the Dancing with the Stars.
Chriselle.
Yes, she was. I loved Chriselle, and she was always.
She seemed really sweet.
She was always jealous of her because, like, everybody liked her. Everybody took to her, you know, and she was just like,
yeah.
No, these are my friends. Go play with your own friends. You can't sit with us. So.
Yeah, and like, honestly, both sides of their stories seem so insane, like, both of their claims, that it's like, so there's got to be some truth, like, somewhere in the middle of that, I feel like.
Yes, very toxic. At the end of the day, I feel sorry for the baby, no matter where he ends up.
Yeah, exactly. That's like the most important thing. Hopefully he's good and doesn't have to see like that insaneness much longer.
Like, for real. It's like,
yeah. Well, it sounds like they're for sure getting divorced, which in their case sounds like a positive thing. So
absolutely.
Best of luck to both of them. Hopefully they can like co-parent, you know, nicely with each other and not make it dramatic for their son.
She's attracted. She likes the drama. She came from a show with drama. I feel she's the type of person that wants the cameras out of her. She hasn't been in the limelight since the show, really. So maybe this is her way of getting back into the limelight. I don't know.
Right. Like, she's trying to stir up some drama to get back in the press.
Maybe. I have no idea.
But crazier things have happened.
All right. Well, now that you heard my toxic story, let's hear your crime.
My toxic story.
I think yours is going to be more than toxic.
Yeah, mine's a little more sad. Yours is sad, but like drama, craziness. This is more like crime sadness. But yeah, this one is about a woman named Jennifer Stahl. She was actually an actress, dancer in the movie Dirty Dancing. She was a rising actress. She was, you know, trying to get her start in Hollywood. And her friends, unfortunately, were involved in a horrific New York tragedy. Before I start, this info comes from Oxygen True Crime, The Direct, and IMDb. So where this all kind of went down was right in the heart of Midtown, which is just a huge touristy place that people go to just see a lot of famous New York City sites. And one of the places that was a big hit was Manhattan's Carnegie Deli. And it was actually famous. I think it's funny because it's a deli, but it was famous for its cheesecake. But it was also big. People loved the pastrami sandwiches and just all of their, you know, decadent eats that they had going on there. But in the springtime of 2001, it unfortunately became the epicenter of a very shocking murder that left the star and four others shot in a robbery gone wrong. So on May 10th, 2001, just a little bit after 7:30 p.m., NYPD officers were dispatched to an apartment above Carnegie Deli. A man named Anthony Vader, he called 911 after freeing himself from restraints, claiming that he and others in the apartment had been shot. And the other people who were the victims of these murders, we're going to kind of go through them and see who they were. So once he called, officers arrived on the scene, one of them being Officer Karen Pan. She described finding a woman with blood all over her clothes and in her hair, standing on the landing of a staircase. The unknown woman, who later was identified as Rosemond Dane, she had her hands behind her back, and authorities were uncertain whether she was armed or not. Karen Pan recalled, when we asked her to move to the side, she just stared at us. And then she actually fainted. And when they got a closer look at her after she passed out, they saw that her hands were duct taped behind her back. So upon entering the apartment, police found the man who called 911 and he was injured. There were two other men later identified as Stephen King and Charles Trey Hellowell.
Stephen King.
I knew you were going to say that. I was going to say different guy.
Was he in Missouri? Is he like a bag of bones now?
I knew it. I was like, Lo's going to say something about Stephen King.
So it's not the Stephen King. Like,
not the different guy. I'm sure he got the comparison all the time, though.
I was like, did he talk to Tony? Did it help him? No. Okay, continue on. I don't have any more children of the corny jokes.
I paused because I knew it was coming. But they were both also found duct taped, but they were dead on the scene, unlike the other ones. According to Officer Pan, they soon found out the apartment's renter, who was Jennifer Stahl, who was 39 at the time, was in a makeshift music studio adjacent to the living room. She was alive, but struggling to breathe. And each of the five victims, they had been shot in the back of the head. An employee at Carnegie Deli later told detectives that she saw two black men running away from the building at the time of the homicides, one of which had dreadlocks. Now, after police got there and were looking around and kind of saw all this, Dane, Vader, and Stahl, they were rushed to a nearby hospital. Although, sadly, Jennifer, she would kind of not do well with her injuries before the morning and ended up passing away.
Could you imagine, though, if that really was Stephen King? Like, this is where all his inspiration came from in one night.
That would be crazy. Especially
since he didn't make it.
Right. So. And it was in 2001.
But what if this is like Sim? Like, what if he
time traveled.
Yeah. Like, maybe this did happen and he did die. But then, like, he came back, and this whole time, he's, like, a ghostwriter.
It turned him pretty dark, and that's why he wrote all these
horrible
stories.
Like, he's really not human. Like, he is really something out of a Stephen King novel, writing King novels.
You're getting deep with it.
Like, okay, but let's continue back on to Jennifer's story.
We'll come back. We'll circle back around to Stephen King. So kind of a little bit about Jennifer. She was born on April 11th, 1962 in, I don't know how you say this, Tuttsville, New Jersey. But she was an actress, mainly known for Dirty Dancing, Firehouse, and Identity Crisis.
I wonder who she was in Dirty Dancing, because I looked her up when you told me that you were doing her, and I thought, oh, maybe it's the sister.
So, oh, yeah, no, I'll go through it. She did not have she had a very small.
Yeah, brain. I'm thinking like she was just like a backup dancer.
She was not, and I'll go through because I pulled some parts of the movie that she was in just to describe. If you guys ever go back and watch it, then you'll know who she was. But she wasn't like a main part of it.
Because I tried to put a face with it. I was like, oh, I wonder if it was the sister. And then I pulled it up. I'm like, I don't remember her. So she must have a very small part.
Yeah, like microscopic. But yeah, she first appeared kind of going through, like I just said, the parts of the movie that she was in. She first appeared in the scene set to The Contours, you know, Do You Love Me? As fans, they see her wearing a dark striped shirt, a black belt, and gray pants, which shortly after, the blonde-haired dancer gets down with a couple of different partners, and she's also seen dancing next to Patrick Swayze. She also later joins another partner behind the Love Man sequence as he's kind of showing some of his dancing expertise to Jennifer Grey's character. She's in the massive group shot featuring Swayze and Grey. She's in front and center. But yeah, she's basically just putting her dance skills on display. That was like it in total. She really only has a few minutes of screen time in Dirty Dancing between the various dance sequences. So she's just a featured dancer in the movie. She wasn't like major character or anything. But yeah, if you go back and watch the movie, look out for her. But that was like her big, you know, that would be huge to dance in that movie.
Oh my God, to be that close to Patrick Swayze.
I know, right? And like for it to become such a huge iconic thing. But yeah, news of this horrific attack, it obviously brought a ton of media outlets to this deli, because it was like super rare for a murder, especially of this caliber, to happen in such a touristy section of the city. And then also coverage was then just, you know, amplified when it was discovered that Jennifer, you know, she was an up and rising actress, dancer, singer, you know, she got the small part in Dirty Dancing. And she actually got that just 2 years after moving to New York. But yeah, once people kind of heard about her and that she was involved, just the media kind of had a frenzy with this. Jennifer's friend, Barbara Coleman, she told New York Homicide that Jen wanted to be a star, and New York is where everything happens. Police also soon learned from the crime scene that Jennifer also had a pretty, you know, lucrative side hustle. She sold marijuana, and she catered to a clientele in the city's theater and media districts. You know, girl, you out there, make your money. Gotta do what you gotta do.
Right.
And when police were there, according to a detective named Irma Rivera, she says there were a bunch of jars, and all of the jars had buds of marijuana in them. She says, "I realized this was not a weed that people sell on the street. It seemed more like a gourmet weed to me." Like, so, oh, gourmet. Like
the Martha Stewart's of weed.
Right, I guess so. But yeah, Jennifer had like a huge network of friends and a lot of accomplished musicians who visited the apartment on pretty much any given day, just in and out. She also had a passion for music, obviously. You know, she was into dancing and singing, which led her to find her then boyfriend, who was a drummer. And weirdly enough, he matched the description of one of the two men seen running away from the crime scene. Her friend Katya, she told New York Homicide that there was a little bit of violence between Jennifer and her boyfriend. In fact, just days before this whole attack happened, Jennifer had broken her pinky during an alleged altercation with him. So a lot of people had suspicions about that, you know, kind of weird. They got into like a heated altercation just a few days before she's like shot and then ends up dying. Even her friends had all their suspicions. They were kind of thinking and leaning towards maybe her boyfriend was involved in this somehow. However, he did have an alibi for himself, and he was quickly ruled out as a suspect. So after they kind of like looked at her boyfriend and was like, okay, it's not him, he's clear, they then turned their attention towards her marijuana business. You know, her friend even said that she had a variety of clientele. She had people who worked in the music industry, rappers, producers, and it was just a lot of her longtime friends. Now, Vader, her friend that was hospitalized and was a hairdresser, he was still hospitalized for his injuries. So he was still alive. And so was Dane, who was hanging out with her boyfriend, Trey Helliwell. And the rest, before Helliwell was shot to death. Now, Stephen King, again, different guy, but maybe not, according to Lowe. He was also a longtime friend of Jennifer's, and he actually was an expectant father, which is really sad. And Jennifer actually hired him to watch the door as business and foot traffic just kind of increased over time. So really sad that he had a baby on the way and he ended up passing away. Her friend Coleman says that she thought she was safe. You know, she didn't really think that the selling marijuana was going to cause her any issues, you know. She would often say, cocaine kicks your door in the middle of the night, marijuana doesn't.
Okay, well, I mean, that's right. Some, words of wisdom to live by.
Right. She's like, I'm sticking with marijuana, skipping the.
But clearly, selling. She had like high end, like delicacy marijuana. Like,
right. Like they described it as gourmet. So, like, you never know. People might knock down your door for that.
Right. I mean, I'm just saying, if your shit's good, it'll come with some problems.
Exactly. But police, they didn't find any reason for any of Jennifer's guests to be targeted for murder. Lieutenant Commander Roger Perino for the Manhattan North Precinct, he said that it appeared to be a robbery or some type of drug deal that was gone very wrong. Now, there was surveillance video from Jennifer's hallway, and it showed two men whose descriptions that the Carnegie Deli worker gave police. It shows them calmly going upstairs towards her apartment and running away moments later, one of them carrying a backpack on the way out. A witness also reported the two suspects getting into a car suspiciously parked around the corner from the crime scene. Following the lead, police found a summons was issued in the area to a vehicle registered to a man named Andre Smith. So now it's been, you know, a few days later, time has gone on, and Vader and Dane, they are still alive and still recovering from their injuries. But thankfully, they were healthy enough to speak with detectives. Both victims said that they were hanging out at the apartment when someone named Sean buzzed up. With Jennifer's permission, Stephen let Sean and his friend enter the apartment before the two suspects announced that they were there to rob them. Dane tried to run before one of the men pulled her back. One of them started duct taping people as they laid face down on the living room floor, and the other grabbed Jennifer and took her into the studio. And Rosemond Dane heard her say, "Just take what you want, please, just don't hurt anybody." Neither of the surviving witnesses could report who pulled the trigger, though. Now, Vader, he played dead, and Dane sustained head wounds that never entered the skull. So police are starting to, like, you know, try to put the pieces together, and they eventually identify suspect number one. So the name Sean kind of rang familiar to Jennifer's friends, and one remembered that a man named Sean Sally had recently submitted a resume to Jennifer, which was according to her friend Michelle. Detectives followed the lead and learned that Sean Sally, was an aspiring rapper and roadie who'd previously worked for George Clinton's Parliament Funkadelic. I personally don't know what that is, but I guess the music collective is known as P-Funk. Do you know what that is, Lo?
Not exactly. I feel like it'd be like a, what would you call it? Like, it sounds almost like a techno type thing.
Yeah, it does. I'm not sure what it is, but either way, he was trying to be a rapper, and he would go on road with different bands and stuff like that. But detectives eventually theorized that that was how Sean and Jennifer knew one another. Because obviously she knew him because she let him into her apartment. Her friend Michelle admitted, "I wasn't sure if it was going to lead to anything, but I had an appointment with detectives, so I went to the precinct in Midtown and brought his resume to them." Sean had a rap sheet across several states for robbery and weapon possession, which obviously piqued detectives' interest because, I mean, we're just getting more and more connections here. His mugshot also matched one of the two suspects captured walking up and down the stairs in Jennifer's apartment building. Later, testing would also prove that it was his fingerprints found on the duct tape used to bind Hallowell and Dane. So, I mean, they got you, dude. They definitely did. And so they obviously had his resume from her friend, and they decided, the investigators, to take the address from his resume and pay a little visit to his Newark, New Jersey residence, where he lived with a friend named Dwayne. Paperwork found in the home proved that Sean lived there, even though when they went to the door, Dwayne denied knowing him at all. ADA Stephen Newsy says, "We knew that Dwayne was lying. When someone lies like that about such a basic fact, an incriminating fact, we were thinking this is the other person who committed the robbery with Sean." I mean, obviously, I feel like Dwayne just totally gave himself away by doing that. So when they started to look into Dwayne, he also had a rap sheet. He claimed that he was refereeing at a local school basketball game, and to detectives' surprise, the alibi checked out. However, while being held on a parole violation, investigators found a piece of paper on Dwayne consisting of a phone number for someone named Dre. So NYPD detectives, they had reservations about, you know, completely clearing Dwayne as a suspect. They weren't 100% trying to, like, you know, cross his name off the list, but they did soon speak with a teenage girl who lived near Sean and Dwayne, and she joined detectives in the squad room to review the surveillance footage from Jennifer's apartment, and she said she identified the men as Sean and Dre, not Dwayne. So now after that, they're kind of like, okay, maybe we can, like, cross Dwayne off our list, and we got to look deeper into this Dre guy. So returning the piece of paper found on Dwayne, police looked up the phone number, which led them to Dre, aka Andre Smith. And it would just so happen that Andre Smith was the man whose car was suspiciously parked near Jennifer's home during the time of this crime.
Man, see, these cops, they didn't forget about Dre.
Right?
They were on it.
They were on it. Oh my gosh. But yeah, Perino told New York Homicide that that puts him obviously in the vicinity of Carnegie Deli the night of the homicide. I mean, clearly his car is right there. He knows Sean. Sean's obviously the main guy who pulled up there. So they're thinking, okay, we really think that it was Sean and Dre. So like Sean, Andre also, he had his own history for robbery and weapons possession charges. Through the summons issued on the night of the murder, detectives learned that Andre lived just 3 miles from Sean in New Jersey, though he was gone before police could find him. Now, shockingly, on May 20th, 2001, Andre, he voluntarily walked in the Midtown North precinct and he agreed to speak with detectives. But he wasn't there to, like, admit anything. He was there to deny knowing anything about the shootings. Andre really did not want to give anything at all, said Detective McNeely. And Detective Irma Rivera, she kind of like, she was trying to get the softer side of him. She said that she was reminded of her brother. Like, he just reminded her of that. And I think she was kind of like pulling at that, trying to like connect with him or something. And after speaking with her for some time, he actually confessed. He claimed that Sean approached him with the idea of robbing a, quote, a hippie chick for cash and weed. And Andre, at the time, was unemployed and was really struggling to provide for his baby, his infant that he had. So he ultimately agreed to go along for the robbery. Andre told detectives that he only intended to help Sean rob the victims and that Sean messed up, according to Detective McNeely, because he says this was not the way it was supposed to go down. You know, he thought he was just going there for a robbery. You know, he says he initially went with Jennifer into the music studio to steal cash and marijuana, while Sean kind of stayed behind with the others. But Sean wasn't moving fast enough, so the suspects switched roles, and as Dre continued restraining the others, Sean just decided to shoot Jennifer at that point.
There's always one overzealous mother effer that has to take it too far, you know.
Right, like, way too far, because that wasn't even...
They should have even taken it there anyway, but...
Right, we're right.
I mean, they're like, okay, a simple robbery or whatever. We're just going to get some weed and money and be in and out. And then it turns to this, and someone who was struggling with doing the right thing and not, I just need money for my baby, doesn't make an excuse. I mean, could have got a job at Burger King. However... Right. It just sucks because now it's like a whole new ball game. And now that baby's missing his father for some time.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, and three people died because of it. Yeah, so Dre said that he witnessed Sean then go and shoot all the others. That night, the suspects returned to Newark and they went their separate ways, says Dre. Now, Police spoke with multiple friends of Sean, hoping to just figure out where he might be hiding because they no one could find him at this point. One said that Sean called them and requested a money wire transfer, and a subsequent trace of a calling card revealed that Sean traveled south before landing in a New Orleans, Louisiana motel. So he like really made his way down south. He went from New York to New Orleans.
In a New York minute.
So NYPD zeroed in, and while they found Sean's belongings, including marijuana believed to have, you know, been taken from Jennifer's apartment, he, of course, still was nowhere to be found. ADA Newsy says, it was clear that we missed him by literally minutes. We knew that he knew we were looking for him. So he was fully on the run. And appealing to the public, because this, you know, at this point was such a huge thing going on. People were very invested. Police pitched the story to the famous television series America's Most Wanted. And it featured the case on July 14th, 2001. And in less than an hour, a tipster reported Sean was living at a homeless shelter in Miami, in Florida.
Dang, someone's just waiting to give him up. They wanted him out.
Right? They saw him and immediately called.
They're like, oh my God, I've been wanting this mother effer out for days. Give me this mother. Right.
Exactly. So Newsy was among the authorities who visited the shelter after police found Sean on site of it. And contradicting Dre, Sean claimed that he accidentally shot Jennifer Stahl while robbing the apartment, and that Dre was the one that shot the other four victims. So just like Lowe's story earlier, this was like a very he said, he said kind of thing. And it couldn't, and it couldn't be determined who killed who, like, because, you know, the two surviving victims didn't know, and they were saying that it was the other one. So they just decided in court that they were both going to get in trouble, and they were both charged with 3 counts of second degree murder, 2 counts of attempted second degree murder, and underlying charges related to robbery and weapons possession.
I like the judge, though. All right. Y'all don't want to tell the truth. Y'all going down, both of you.
Yep, exactly.
That's how it should
okay.
be.
Yeah. Okay. Yep, 100%. So according to Newsy, Sean admitted he first approached Dwayne about committing the robbery. But when Dwayne was unavailable, he then introduced Sean to Andre Smith. And that's kind of how he got him involved. So on June 18th, 2002, Sean and Andre were found guilty as charged, and they were later sentenced to 120 years to life behind bars. You know, it was definitely closure for the families of those who passed away, and also to the survivors, Rosamund Dane and Anthony Vader. Holly Hallowell, she was the sister of one of the victims. She says, I remember Andre standing up and looking us in the eye and apologizing. She says, but Sean Sally never did. And it was also the end of a chapter for obviously those who were fans and who fondly remembered Jennifer Stahl. Her friend says she still had years ahead. Who knows what she could have done and what she could have created. Kind of a side note, Jennifer then became the subject of the Netflix documentary Homicide New York, which was started by Law & Order creator Dick Wolf. And I guess it just kind of like goes into the recollections of her death and other deaths that are that have happened in New York over the years. And she also had an episode featured on Oxygen Channel as well.
You know, it makes me think that, I mean, they're both guilty no matter what. And, you know, even if Andre didn't pull the trigger, he's guilty by association. He went for the robbery, however it played out. He was still a part of the beginning of the chaos, you know. But I feel like since he apologized, to me that shows a little bit of remorse. To me that shows a little bit of, maybe he's saying, you know, I didn't, like, I'm apologizing this happened. I'm sorry this happened. Like, in his way of, like, I know I didn't pull the trigger, but I'm guilty because, you know, the asshole over here that I was friends with did.
Right.
So almost like apologizing on his behalf as well. And since the other one was so cold and never even stood up for his actions, which kind of makes me feel like he'd be the cold member, the, you know.
Yeah, I for sure think so. And the fact that, like, you know, Andre, at first he denied it to police, but then he eventually admitted being a part of it and, like, gave them the details, where Sean, he completely ran away for a long time to, like, different states until he was eventually found. And then, yeah, just to be so, like, cold and, like, blame it on Andre is kind of like, I mean, and yeah, Andre could have, who really knows, but the fact that he at least said sorry to the families showed a little bit more character than what Sean had.
That's what I was thinking, like, his conscience is speaking somewhere, which makes me think, you know, because Sean doesn't seem to have one, that it makes me think he was more the ringleader, more the hothead, more the, you know, I don't care how this plays out, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that was, well, the, I don't know, the deli murder. Even though it didn't technically happen in the deli, it happened above the deli, but, you know.
Right.
And if you guys go back to watch Dirty Dancing, look out for Jennifer's scenes.
For sure. So I looked up the Funkadelics.
P-Funk.
This is called Give Up the Funk.
Sounds very funky.
Yeah. I mean, it's all about
to the name.
For sure. This is called Erotic City. And I know that one from Prince. So I know this.
Maybe they did it. Maybe they did a cover.
They must have did it first. Because I know Prince version of this. I used to love Prince version. My life is literally a guy dancing in a diaper.
These lyrics.
Swing down, sweet chariot. It sounds like though someone redid this in a hip hop version.
This one has like jazz vibes to it.
Who does it though? Who's the hip hop singer? Let Me Ride. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
And say, swing down, sweet chariot,
I'm back. Okay, I know there's someone redid that. You'll know.
Maybe, well, since you know, like, other songs, maybe those were just, like, maybe they only did cover songs. So, like, maybe those people did the, whatever they're called, psychedelic funks. Maybe they only did covers.
No, I feel that was a real band. I think somebody did Let Me Ride. They took that.
From G-Thang to P-Funk. Back to G-Funk. Swing down, sweet cherry, stop. Let me
ride. Swing down, sweet cherry, stop. Let me ride. This is Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre.
Okay. I like this better.
So yeah, that there's still another version of Let Me Ride. It's getting closer, but when I really hear it,
you'll know.
And you know what's funny? It's gonna happen like tomorrow. I'm gonna get in the car and I'm like, oh my god, this is it. And I'm gonna have to like
it's gonna like come on the radio.
It is, because anytime we talk about something, like it plays for like weeks after.
It turns
out everywhere.
No, literally you're gonna hear it on the radio within like the next 3 days.
But okay, well, yeah, it's another bummer story. It was another minor celebrity murder. However, there was no Beatles involved. There was no obsessive stalker crazy mamas boys involved. So we're getting off the beaten path.
right. This was more like, you know, they just wanted that gourmet weed. And it turned out bad.
You know, I think Martha Stewart and Snoop should come up with some, seriously, they should call it like the gourmet.
Honestly, they should.
I mean, she's already got her face on bottles. He's got his face on wine bottles. I still think it'd be epic if he got her in a rap video and had her drop a line. I'm just saying.
That would be iconic. I don't know why.
She's got him cooking and sipping wine. Can you imagine like Martha Stewart in one of his videos and all of a sudden she's got like a bandana and a hoodie on and she's like rapping a couple of lines with him?
No, that would be incredible. Like that would make
my
life. Oh
my gosh. A big gold chain hanging down like him.
Sideways hat.
Oh, that'd be so cool.
Incredible. Let's make that happen.
No, I will try to put out there to my people. I mean,
yeah. Have your people call her people.
And by my people, it's, you know, hopefully one day Dax will hear this and he'll pass it on to Snoop. You know what I mean?
Right. Exactly. Well, all right, guys. Thank you for sticking around for another one.
Yes. And next week we will have another fun-filled episode.
Yes, ma'am, as always.
But until then, we got to go.
Stay creepy.
We out.
Bye.
Bye.